Mother's Questions and Answers, November 16th, 1955. This is part one of two parts. In this class, Mother speaks about the significance of the number 18, and then she explains the different combinations that can add up to 18. She tells the students that the numbers 6 plus 12, which of course add up to 18, are something really good. She explains that the number 12 is the number of perfection in conception and creation, and the number 6 is the number of the new creation. She says that if you put 12 and 6 together, you truly have something absolutely remarkable. And most people are familiar with Mother's symbol, and we know it is designed with 12 outside sections, or petals. Mother said her symbol is a fully opened lotus flower. And when she named flowers, she called the white lotus Aditi, which means the Divine Mother. Mother said that 12 is the figure of the Mahashakti, the full great power of the Supreme, which contains everything as the Divine Mother. The Matra Mandir has 12 pillars and 12 surrounding meditation chambers called petals, and it is designed as though it is Mother's symbol lying on the earth. Sri Aurobindo said the 12 sections of the Mother's symbol represent the 12 vibrations necessary for the complete manifestation of the supramental force here. The name Sri Aurobindo has 12 letters. Mother's given name, Mira Alfasa, has 12 letters. Mother is 6 letters. And Mother said that we really have 12 senses, not the 6 senses that we're always taught we have. What's really interesting is that the important dates in the lives of both Mother and Sri Aurobindo come in 6-year cycles. The most important ones come in 6 plus 2, or 12-year cycles. And Mother said that the succession of 12 years marks the most momentous spiritual events in Sri Aurobindo's life. Oroville Archives has a list of the 6 and 12-year cycles in the lives of Mother and Sri Aurobindo. It's really absolutely fascinating. The first year, 1872, Sri Aurobindo's birth year. 1878, 6 years later, Sri Aurobindo is 6 years old, Mother is born. 1884, Sri Aurobindo is 12, Mother is at age 6, and she said this was a significant year for the progression of her being's consciousness here. 1890, at age 18, Sri Aurobindo entered Cambridge University. 1896, Sri Aurobindo's 24, Mother is 18. She says this year marked the beginning of her artistic and vital development. She had married Morissette, the Impressionist painter, in 1887, and she went forward for a long time as a part of the Impressionist movement in France. In 1902, Sri Aurobindo was 30, Mother is 24. Sri Aurobindo began his active part in the working for India's freedom. And this is the year that Mother first came into contact with the teaching of Max Theon, who was her teacher in occultism. In 1908, Sri Aurobindo is 36, and he is arrested and jailed for 1 year. And as he said, he was forced by the divine to slow down and leave political work. During that year in jail, he realized the divine. In that year, 1908, Mother separated from her husband, Henri Morissette, and she started spending time with Paul Richard, starting a 12-year period of concentration on the mental development. And this is something that Mother said. The mental development concentration started at that time. In 1914, Sri Aurobindo is 42, Mother is 36, They meet for the first time on the physical plane. Mother comes to Pondicherry and they start their work together, and Sri Aurobindo starts writing the Arya. And the Arya was a major work that had a very strong effect on the whole country of India. 6 years later, in 1920, Mother is 42, and she returns to Pondi for the rest of her life. Another 6 years, Sri Aurobindo is 54, and he has the major realization of the overmind consciousness which comes in him and makes a stable base which allows him to bring down the supramental forces. At this time, in 1926, he retires to his room for good. 6 years later, in 1932, Mother is 54, and she goes through a period of illness where she's extremely sick for 1 month, and it marks a major change in all her activity in the ashram and with her disciples. 6 years from that, Sri Aurobindo is 66, and this is the year he breaks his leg, and he's confined to bed, which he basically doesn't really leave for the rest of his life. In 1944, Sri Aurobindo is 72, and that's the same number as the year of his birth in 1872. Mother has succeeded in establishing the ashram school. The official starting date was a little bit before, on December 2nd, 43. In 1850, Sri Aurobindo is 78, the year of Mother's birth. Mother is 72, the year of Sri Aurobindo's birth. And this is the time that Sri Aurobindo voluntarily chooses to leave his body. In 1856, 6 years later, Mother is now 78, Sri Aurobindo's birth year 100 years before, and there comes the very first manifestation of the supramental consciousness on Earth. In 1962, Mother retires permanently to her room to concentrate on her inner work. And we can notice that 62 is the reverse of 26, when Sri Aurobindo retired in 1926. In 1968, 6 years later, Mother is 90, and she starts Auroville. In 1974, Mother has already left her body. She left about a month and a half before the new year of 1974, and about 3.5 months before her 96th birthday. So this last date of Mother's action in her physical body on the physical plane is not exactly on the mark of the 6 and 12 year cycles. But the 6 year cycles do continue, and they can be traced after that, and most likely they will continue. Mother calls the pomegranate flower divine love. And in this class, she tells the children that she always distributes the petals of the divine love flower on the day of Kali Puja. Kali Puja is the ceremony for the Indian goddess Kali. And Mother gives out divine love flowers because her love is the most active love and the most powerful love. Mother is well known for naming flower essences, for showing us how they correspond to different universal movements that are also in us. And there are also many stories about how Mother used flowers to give forces to ashramites and to people who came to see her. Mother first learned that flowers could receive and transmit forces while she was still living in Paris around the turn of the 20th century. And we have seen in the list of the years that in 1902, she first came into contact with Max Theon. She learned through some action of Theon's wife that she could put forces into flowers. And the flowers that she learned with are the flowers of the divine love. Mrs. Theon, whose name was Alma sent Mother the petals of divine love and told her that they were carrying her protection and force. So Mother tells a whole story about this. And here's the story. All the flowers to which I have given a significance receive exactly the force which I put into them and transmit it. People don't always receive it, because most of the time they are less receptive than the flower, and they waste the force that has been put into it through their lack of consciousness and receptivity. But the force is there, and the flower receives it wonderfully. I knew this a long time ago, 50 years ago. There was that occultist who later gave me lessons in occultism for 2 years. It was Max Theon. His wife, Alma, was a wonderful clairvoyant, and she had an absolutely remarkable capacity, precisely, of transmitting forces. They were living in Tlemcen, Algeria, and I was living in Paris. I used to correspond with them, but I had not yet met them at all. And then one day, Alma sent me in a letter, petals of the pomegranate flower, Divine's Love. At that time, I had not given the meaning to the flower. She sent me petals of the pomegranate flower, telling me that these petals were bringing me her protection and force. Now, at that time, I used to wear my watch on a chain. Wristwatches were not known then, or there were very few of them. And there was also a small 18th century magnifying glass. It was quite small, as large as this. And Mother makes a gesture with her fingers showing the size of these tiny glasses. And it had two lenses, you see, like all reading glasses. There were two lenses mounted on a small golden frame, and it was hanging from my chain. Now, between the two glasses, I put these petals, and I used to carry this about with me always, because I wanted to keep it with me, you see. I trusted this lady, and knew she had power. I wanted to keep this with me, and I always felt a kind of energy, warmth, confidence, a force which came from that thing. I did not think about it, you see, but I felt it like that. And then one day, suddenly, I felt quite depleted, as though a support that was there had gone. Something very unpleasant. I said, "It is strange. What has happened? Nothing really unpleasant has happened to me. Why do I feel like this? So empty, emptied of energy." And in the evening, when I took off my watch and chain, I noticed that one of the small glasses had come off, and all the petals were gone. There was not one petal left. Then I really knew that they carried a considerable charge of power, for I had felt the difference without even knowing the reason. I didn't know the reason, and it had made a considerable difference. So it was after this that I saw how one could use flowers by charging them with forces. They are extremely receptive. Mother wrote a story about why the flowers of the pomegranate bush express and contain the Divine's Love. She called it an old Chaldean legend. The story is printed as an appendix to the text of this class, because a child asks her about it, and she speaks something about it. So here's the story. An old Chaldean legend. Long, long ago, in the dry land which is now Arabia, a divine being incarnated upon earth to awaken in it the supreme love. As expected, it was persecuted by men, misunderstood, suspected, pursued. Mortally wounded by its assailants, it wanted to die quietly in solitude in order to be able to accomplish its work. And being pursued, it ran away. Suddenly, in the vast desert land, there appeared a small pomegranate bush. The Savior crept in under the low branches to leave its body in peace. And immediately the bush spread out. Miraculously, it grew higher, larger, became deep and thick, so that when the pursuers passed by, they did not even suspect that the one whom they were chasing was hidden there, and they went their way. While drop by drop the sacred blood fell, fertilizing the soil, the bush was covered with marvelous flowers, scarlet, large, crowded with petals, innumerable drops of blood. These are the flowers which express and contain for us the divine's love. This week again, we have the tape recording of Mother's class. It will play automatically after the English reading is finished. So we're in the playground, Mother's Friday class. It's the 16th of November, 1955. This is the first part of the class. And Mother has read from the Synthesis of Yoga, still the chapter on the four aids. And then she speaks to a child and she says, "Have you prepared a question for your birthday?" And the child asks, "What is the significance of 18? And Mother says, "Of the number 18? And then there's a silence, and then Mother says, "It depends on how it is read. It can be read as 10 plus 8. It can be read as 9 plus 9. It can be read as 12 plus 6. And each of these readings has a different meaning." And then again there's a small silence, and Mother says, "If we take 10 plus 8, it can indicate something quite immobile, because 10 indicates a static perfection, something which has reached its perfection and stops there. And 8 is a double enclosure, that is, something which is framed in, surrounded, demarcated, and which naturally stops there. So if we put 10 and 8 together, it truly makes something which can be an accomplishment, but one that is terminated. On the other hand, if we take 9 plus 9, 9 is the process of creation, not the creation itself, but its process of creation. And 9 plus 9 is a process of creation which continues and follows another process of creation, that is, a creation which is dual and implies the idea that it continues indefinitely. This gives us two meanings, which are almost contradictory. And if we take 12 and 6, then it becomes something very good. 12, you know what it is, don't you? It is the number of perfection in conception and creation. And 6 is the number of the new creation. So if you put 12 and 6 together, you truly have something absolutely remarkable. Now we can have other combinations, but it becomes a little more complicated." And then a child asks Mother, "In the prayer you gave us this time for Kali Puja, you have written something in Sanskrit." And Mother answers, "It is Sri Aurobindo who has written a mantra. And the mantra that he's written is Om Anandamayi Chaitanyamayi Satyamayi Parame. Om," Mother said, "was the sound of the creation." And then, so it goes, the sound of the creation, bliss-filled, consciousness-filled, truth-filled, supreme being. And a child says, "Then why has he written it like this?" And Mother says, "Why has he written this?" And then, in a very quiet, matter-of-fact voice, and we remember that Sri Aurobindo left in 5 years before, and that Mother always said that he didn't go anywhere. And so Mother simply says, "Why has he written this? Why don't you ask him? Perhaps he'll tell you." It is an evocation. You know what it means? Did you find someone to explain it to you? No. Ah, that's the first thing you should have done. Ask what the meaning of these four words is. The transcription underneath, there are only two of them. He had begun transcribing, and then his paper, it was on a tiny little scrap of paper, and there wasn't any more space to write everything, so he stopped. And then you hear the children's laughter on the tape. And Mother says, "Have you read it? You don't know how to read Sanskrit. So now you must find someone to show you how to read it, and then to give you the significance. And after that, you will ask me why he wrote it. Not now." And then there's a silence, and then a child says, "Sweet mother, has that Chaldean legend which you have written any relation with Kali Puja?" And mother says, "Yes, my child, because on Kali Puja day, I always distribute the flowers of divine's love. For Kali is the most loving of all the aspects of the Mahashakti. Her love is the most active and the most powerful love. And that is why every year I distribute the petals of divine's love on Kali's day." And so, naturally, this explanation of why these flowers were chosen to express the divine's love, it is a sufficient explanation. And then a child refers to the Chaldean legend, and he asks, "Mother, who was this man you have spoken about?" And mother responds, "Who told you that it was a man? I haven't said whether it was a man or a woman. I took care to put only a divine being." And the child persists and asks, "Who?" And mother says, "It's a prehistoric story. So you cannot find any information about it. It isn't written anywhere. There are no written documents." And then there's a silence, and finally mother says, "Haven't you any questions to ask on what we read today?" And then a child says, "Sweet mother, is personal effort always egoistic?" And mother says, "There we are, you see. French is not as rich a language as we could hope for. In English, there are two words. You see, they are selfish and egoistic. And they don't mean the same thing. You know the difference in English, don't you? Well, in this case, the French word ism is in the sense of egoism in English, not in the sense of selfishness. There may be an effort which is not at all selfish and is yet egoistic, because the moment it is personal, it is egoistic. That means it is based on the ego. But it does not mean that it is not generous, compassionate, unselfish, nor that it is for narrow personal ends. It is not like that. It may be for a very unselfish work. But so long as an ego is there, it is egoistic. And so long as the sense of one's own personality is there, it is naturally something egoistic. It is founded on the presence of the ego. And this must last for a fairly long time, because it must last until the individuality is completely formed, until it has reached a certain stage of individual perfection. Then the presence of the ego is no longer necessary. But not before one has attained the maximum individual development. It's not just a tiny little job. It asks for much time and much effort. And when one has attained the perfection of his own development, when one is an individual being who is truly personal, that is, who who has all the characteristics of something different from all others. For, in principle, there are no two individualities exactly alike in the world. Then, when one has succeeded in expressing the individuality one is exclusively, represents exclusively in the universal creation, then one is ready for the ego to disappear, but not before. It asks for a certain length of time, not a little effort, a fairly complete education. But one may be quite unselfish long before being ready not to have the ego any longer. That is something else. For years, all the time I have been translating from English into French, that is for a very long time, something like 30 years of this work, perhaps 35, I have tried to find two words to say that, to make a difference. I haven't found them yet, because in French one can't fabricate words. It's not allowed. That's the misfortune. In English, you can make as many words as you like, and if they are fine and well made, they are accepted. In French, unless it is recognized by the French Academy in its dictionary, you will be told, this is not correct. So I haven't found them yet. And then there's a silence, and then Mother is looking at a child, and she says in a very low and serious voice, he is up to some mischief. And then we hear Mother's laughter and the children's laughing. And then in a very soft voice, which must be a little girl, she says, sweet mother, a rich man is never satisfied. He wants to have more riches. A scholar wants to have more knowledge. Does this show that they are seeking the divine? And mother says, and then what? And the child repeats her question a second time. And mother answers, he is in search of an absolute in life. That's obvious. Perhaps it's analogous. I don't know. So then the child reads the quotation out. It is this, to enjoy him in all experience of passivity and activity, of peace and of power, of unity and of difference, is the happiness which the jiva, the individual soul manifested in the world, is obscurely seeking. And mother says, yes, but you are not told anything about the love of riches, or the love of power, or the love of knowledge. You are told about the divine love. It is not altogether the same thing. Nothing is said about enjoying ambition, or desire, or even aspiration. What is spoken of is the enjoying of the divine presence. That's completely different. There is no similarity. And then there's a small silence, and then Mother says, I admit that I don't quite catch the meaning of your question. I think you are mixing up the divine with growth and increase and development, no? Perhaps at best you are mixing it up with progress. But it is not the same thing. Progress is perhaps the base upon which the world was constructed. One can take it like that. But it is not the divine. What were you trying to say? And the child says, for each being there is a thirst for something. And mother says, that the thirst for something is the divine? No, my child. It can be quite simply a desire. How can the thirst for something be the divine? And then there's a small silence, and then mother says, I see clearly what you are obscurely trying to say, but truly you do not say it. That is, this inner flame of aspiration is what you call the divine. This inner flame of aspiration which never dies out, which always burns more and more, And that is what in India is called Agni, you know, the will to progress, the power of aspiration. This is what you call the divine. It is an aspect of the divine, that's true. But it is not the divine. It is only one aspect, that is, a divine way of being.
Ça dépend de comment on le lit. On peut le lire 10 plus 8. On peut le lire 9 plus 9. On peut le lire 12 plus 6. Chacun de ces lectures a un sens différent. Si nous prenons 10 plus 8, ça veut dire quelque chose d'assez immobile. Parce que 10 est une perfection statique. Quelque chose qui est arrivé à sa perfection et qui s'arrête là. Et 8 est une double collocture. C'est-à-dire quelque chose qui est encadré, entouré, délimité et qui naturellement s'arrête là. Alors si nous mettons 10 et 8 ensemble, ça fait vraiment quelque chose qui peut être un accomplissement mais qui est terminé. Au contraire, si nous prenons 9 plus 9, 9 est le procédé de la création. Pas la création elle-même, mais son procédé. Et 9 plus 9, c'est un procédé de création qui continue et suit un autre procédé de création, c'est-à-dire une création qui est duelle et qui implique l'idée qu'elle continue indéfiniment, qui fait que les deux sens sont presque contradictoires. Et si on prend 12 et 6, alors ça devient quelque chose de très bien. 12, vous savez ce que c'est, n'est-ce pas? C'est le nombre de la perfection dans la conception et la création. Et 6, c'est le nombre de la création nouvelle. Alors, si vous mettez 12 et 6 à la fois, vous avez vraiment quelque chose de tout à fait remarquable. Maintenant, on peut en avoir d'autres. Mais ça devient un peu plus compliqué. Dix-huit lui-même, en tant que 18, c'était le chiffre de la conscience dans son effort de réalisation matérielle. La conscience essayant de se réaliser matériellement, de s'exprimer matériellement. Alors maintenant, tu es pourvu. Chiffre de la majorité, la première majorité, c'est-à-dire qu'à partir de 18 ans, on a une volonté propre, on a le droit d'avoir une volonté propre au point de vue social. C'est évidemment un point de départ très intéressant. Voilà.
Les chiffres de chacun, est-ce que ça a une significance différente pour chacun?
Si on veut la donner, oui. Si on n'y pense pas, ça ne signifie rien du tout. C'est l'importance qu'on lui donne qui compte. Les chiffres sont une façon de parler. C'est un langage, comme toutes les sciences, tous les arts, tout ce que l'homme produit, c'est toujours une façon de parler, c'est un langage. Si on adopte ce langage, ça devient vivant, expressif, utile, comme nous avons besoin de mots pour nous faire comprendre généralement. Malheureusement, c'est sujet à toutes sortes de confusions, mais enfin, nous ne sommes pas arrivés encore à l'état où on peut communiquer dans le silence, ce qui serait évidemment un état très supérieur. Eh bien, si on veut donner aux chiffres un sens dans sa vie, ils peuvent vous révéler un nombre considérable de choses. Mais c'est comme ça. C'est comme l'astrologie. Si on veut étudier la relation entre son existence et le mouvement des astres, on peut aussi trouver toutes sortes de renseignements utiles. Au fond, c'est une façon de connaître, pas autre chose. Un procédé. La connaissance vraie est au-delà des mots, au-delà des systèmes, au-delà des langages. Elle est dans une identité silencieuse. C'est au fond la seule qui ne se trompe point. Quoi d'autre?
Il faut dans la prière que tu nous as donné, c'est toi qui nous as écrit, qui a écrit quelque chose en français.
C'est sur Bido qui a écrit le mantra.
Avec Pourquoi est-ce qu'on a écrit comme ça?
Pourquoi il a écrit ça? Pourquoi tu ne lui demandes pas? Peut-être pas qu'il te le dirait. C'est une évocation. Tu sais ce que ça veut dire? Tu as trouvé quelqu'un pour te l'expliquer, non? Ah, c'est la première chose que tu aurais dû faire. Demander quel était le sens de ces quatre mots. La transcription en dessous, il n'y en avait que deux. Il avait commencé à transcrire et puis son papier, c'était sur un tout petit bout de chiffon de papier. Et il n'y avait plus de place pour mettre tout, alors il s'est arrêté. Tu as lu, tu ne sais pas lire le sanskrit. Alors maintenant, il faut que tu trouves quelqu'un pour te montrer comment le lire et puis pour te donner la signification. Et puis après, tu me demanderas pourquoi il l'a écrit. Pas maintenant. Oui, mon enfant, parce que Kalipuja, je distribue toujours les fleurs de l'amour divin, parce que Kali est la plus aimante de tous les aspects de la Mahashakti. C'est l'amour le plus actif et le plus puissant. Et c'est pour ça que chaque année, je distribue ces pétales de l'amour divin le jour de Kali. Et alors, naturellement, c'est l'explication de pourquoi ces fleurs ont été choisies pour exprimer l'amour divin. Explication suffisante.
Qui était cet homme?
Hein?
Qui était cet homme, celui de qui tu as parlé?
Qui te dit que c'est un homme? Je n'ai dit ni que c'était un homme, ni que c'était une femme. J'ai eu soin de mettre seulement un être divin. C'est une histoire préhistorique. Alors, je ne peux pas trouver de renseignements là, ce qui est écrit nulle part. Il n'y a pas de document écrit. Il n'y a pas de question à poser sur ce que nous avons lu aujourd'hui.
Mais est-ce que l'état personnel est toujours égoïste?
N'est-ce pas? Voilà, le français n'est pas une langue aussi riche qu'on pourrait l'espérer. En anglais, il y a deux mots. selfish and egoistic. Et ça n'a pas le même sens. Vous savez la différence en langue, n'est-ce pas? Eh bien, dans ce cas-là, c'est l'égoïsme dans le sens de égoïsme en anglais. Ce n'est pas dans le sens de selfish. On peut avoir un effort qui ne soit pas du tout selfish et qui est pourtant égoïste parce que du moment que c'est personnel, c'est égoïste. Ça veut dire que c'est basé sur l'ego. Mais ça ne veut pas dire que ce n'est ni généreux, ni compatissant, ni désintéressé, ni que c'est pour des fins personnelles. N'est-ce pas comment étroite. N'est pas pour ça. Ça peut être pour une œuvre très désintéressée, mais tant qu'il y a un ego là, c'est égoïste. Et tant qu'il y a le sens de sa personnalité à soi, c'est naturellement une chose égoïste. C'est basé sur la présence de l'ego. Et ça doit durer assez longtemps, parce que ça doit durer jusqu'à ce que l'individualité soit complètement formée, qu'elle ait atteint un certain état de perfection individuelle. Alors, la présence de l'ego n'est plus nécessaire, mais pas avant. Qu'on soit arrivé au maximum de développement individuel. C'est une toute petite besoin. Ça demande beaucoup de temps et beaucoup d'efforts. Et quand on est arrivé à la perfection de son développement, qu'on est un être individuel qui est vraiment personnel, c'est-à-dire qui a toutes les caractéristiques de quelque chose qui se distingue de tous les autres. Parce qu'en principe, il n'y a pas deux individualités semblables dans le monde. Alors, quand on est arrivé à exprimer ce que l'individualité que l'on est exclusivement, représente exclusivement dans la création universelle, là on est prêt pour que l'ego disparaisse, mais pas d'autre. Ça demande un certain temps, pas mal d'efforts, une éducation un peu complète. Mais on peut être très unselfish longtemps avant d'être prêt à ne plus avoir d'ego. Depuis des années, depuis que je traduis de l'anglais en français, c'est-à-dire, il y a très longtemps, il y a quelque chose comme 30 ans de ça, peut-être 35. J'ai toujours essayé de trouver deux mots pour dire ça, pour faire une différence. Je n'ai pas trouvé encore. Parce qu'en français, on ne peut pas fabriquer des mots. C'est pas permis, c'est ça qui est malheureux. En anglais, vous faites autant de mots que vous voulez, et s'ils sont jolis et bien faits, ils sont acceptés. En français, à moins que ça ne soit reconnu par l'Académie française dans son dictionnaire, on vous dira ça, c'est pas correct. Alors, je n'ai pas encore.
Un homme riche veut avoir plus de richesse. Un homme veut avoir le savoir plus riche. Écoutez, n'est-ce que cela m'a pu rechercher le bien? Un homme qui est riche, il n'est jamais satisfait. Il veut avoir plus de richesse.
Oui.
Un savant aussi veut avoir plus de connaissances.
Oui.
Est-ce que c'est la main qui cherche le bien?
Il est à la recherche d'un absolu dans la vie. C'est évident, peut-être que c'est contigu, je ne sais pas.
Oui,
mais on ne te parle pas de l'amour des richesses, ou de l'amour du pouvoir, ou de l'amour de la connaissance, on te parle de l'amour divin. Ce n'est pas tout à fait la même chose. On ne parle pas de goûter une ambition, ou un désir, ou une aspiration, mais on parle de goûter la présence divine. C'est tout à fait différent, il n'y en a aucune analogie. J'avoue que je ne saisis pas très bien le sens de ta question. Peut-être au mieux le progrès. Mais c'est pas la même chose. Le progrès est peut-être la base sur laquelle le monde actuel a été construit. On peut le prendre comme ça, mais ce n'est pas le divin. Qu'est-ce que tu essayais de dire?
Chaque être en forme de quelque chose.
Tu la soif pour quelque chose, c'est le divin. Non. Ça peut être tout simplement un désir. comment est-ce que la soif par quelque chose peut être vivée. Je vois bien ce que tu essayes de dire obscurément, mais vraiment tu ne le dis pas. C'est-à-dire que cette flamme d'inspiration intérieure, c'est ça que tu appelles le dire. Cette flamme d'aspiration intérieure qui ne s'éteint jamais, qui brûle toujours, qui brûle de plus en plus. Ce que dans l'Inde on appelle Agni, n'est-ce pas? La volonté de progrès, le pouvoir d'aspiration. C'est ça que tu appelles le divin, c'est un aspect du divin, ça c'est vrai. Mais ce n'est pas le divin, c'est seulement un aspect. C'est-à-dire une manière d'être divin.